Why go to Palestine? To leave our cozy American comfort zone. I'm a teacher, and at St. Louis University, I teach a class called Social Justice in the Theology Department. And in the fall of 2002, I had an amazing group of students. And I always begin the class, sort of like what we just did, by getting people to start talking with one another. And I ask people to introduce themselves, but a little bit more than name and major, which they're used to. And sometimes introductions can take the first 2 weeks of class. Some teachers start lecturing the first minute. So one day, early that semester, maybe it was the second day of class, four or five people had introduced themselves, and then another person volunteered. We do it Quaker style. When someone's moved to introduce herself, then she speaks. We don't start here and go this way. And this one young woman said something along the lines of, "Hello, my name is Zaina. I'm a Palestinian refugee. I'm pre-med, and I'm probably the only Palestinian American that loves country and Western music." And a couple more people introduced themselves, and then I took a pause. And I said, "Is there anyone who would like to make a comment or ask a follow-up question to the students who've been so kind as to introduce themselves?" And one young woman had the most perplexed look on her face. And she turned to Zaina and said, "What is a Palestinian refugee?" So Zaina told us, among other things, it meant her family fled Palestine in 1948, moved to Kuwait, then moved to Lebanon. Her mother was the first female engineering graduate at the American University of Beirut. Then they moved to the United States. For Palestinian families, this diasporic experience is very common. She took several minutes to tell us this. And I think you could hear the proverbial pin drop. That was several years ago. But I think many of those students who will have forgotten much that I said in that class will remember Zaina and her presentation of what a Palestinian refugee's life has been like. Later that semester, she and two other students, Layla and Lubna, went to the University of Michigan for a conference on solidarity with the Palestinian people. And they came back very excited, exuberant. They wanted to help out. And they spoke very admiringly of a group called the International Solidarity Movement, which offered solidarity to the Palestinian people and its people from all over the world. Little did those three students know that they planted a seed in me that later hopefully bore fruit. I had been teaching at that university for 6 years, and as some of you may know, the seventh year is a sabbatical year. So I decided that as an adjunct, that I don't get a sabbatical, I decided to take one. And one of my requirements for my students is they have to do what I call an insertion. They have to leave the lovely campus of St. Louis University and insert themselves someplace in the community to do the work of justice or to do the works of mercy or to confront a different world. You don't have to go to Mexico to encounter a different world. You can do it right in the greater St. Louis area. But I ask my students to do this. I have to do it too. So I thought, how can I leave my comfort zone? How can I insert myself? And a friend and I had been talking about doing some traveling, and we decided we would work with the International Solidarity Movement in occupied Palestine, that is the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Why go to Palestine? To interfere with injustice. That's not my line. I got it from a great rabbi, Abraham Joshua Heschel. He said the essence of prophetic activity is to interfere with injustice. Now, this community heard early on today from Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Some would say she is prophetic for her interference. A couple weeks ago, we honored Dr. King, an American hero and icon, because he interfered with American racism and American militarism, too. I'm guessing that many of us in this room are very familiar with the issue of the need for security for the people of Israel. Knowing the history of the 20th century, but then also the history of anti-Semitism in Christian Europe, it's obvious, it's clear that the Jewish people need security. That's, I think, a fairly uncontroversial thing to say. Further, our government gives great support to Israel, whether it's diplomatically at the UN, economically, militarily, politically. Israel has many friends in this country. A question I have often pondered: what about Palestinian security? What about the well-being of the Palestinians? And this group that I wanted to do my sabbatical with, the International Solidarity Movement, they have a focus. They wish to use nonviolent action in the spirit of Dr. King, in the spirit of Mohandas Gandhi, to interfere with the Israeli occupation, which is deemed by international law illegal. Now, you can imagine that internationals, many of them are young, like 22. I was the old man there. Israel's not exactly itching for internationals to come to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In fact, when they find out that you're working with a group like this, they'll send you home. I went with two friends from St. Louis and Louisville, Kentucky. I've had former students go. I've known people from different parts of the U.S. go to Palestine. And what did we try to do? Some of us tried to interfere with the demolition of Palestinian homes. I think you know, Mr. Elliott, at least one person, somewhat famous, Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old American student, several years ago was bulldozed to death trying to defend a physician's home. Some of us interfere with the abuse Palestinians face at checkpoints in the West Bank. Some of us have interfered with the hardship imposed by roadblocks, and we will try to physically remove the dirt, the concrete. Now, often the Israelis will put the roadblock back, but for the Palestinians, it is a momentary triumph. Some of us interfere by reporting back on what is happening to ordinary Palestinians. I didn't ask you the image or the association you first have with Palestinian, but for many in our country, it is terrorist. And I've had people say they're all terrorists, meaning the Muslims. Of course, there were a fair number of Christians in that area, but they have been leaving because life is just so hard. Others of us have interfered by publicly protesting the separation wall, which is being built in the West Bank. Others have interfered by working with farmers picking olives, walking children to school, or riding in ambulances. Now, all of those don't sound problematic, controversial. But sometimes Israeli settlers would come to the olive groves with their rifles and intimidate, beat, break bones. The thought was, if internationals like us, I with my white skin and American passport, if we're there, maybe the harm will be less. Maybe they will retreat, although we're not under delusions of grandeur. I know one 70-year-old Jewish American who was doing this work, and a settler broke his leg and bit the rabbi working alongside him. And some of us have tried to interfere by speaking to folks back home about what we witnessed there. I also think that President Carter, who some of you may have heard, has also been interfering on this issue with his book and his statements. His book is called Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid. Why go to Palestine? To comfort the afflicted. My student Lubna, who is a Muslim, said, "You're so lucky to be able to go to Palestine, a Muslim country, during Ramadan, the month-long fast." But she said, "It's a wonderful time to celebrate. It's a great family and friend time when you break the fast at about 5:30. People stay out, in the towns anyway, on the streets, visiting, celebrating, you know, till 11, 12 at night, which doesn't happen the rest of the year." So I tried to remember that as I was fasting in the olive groves when it was 95 degrees. No water either, by the way. But Ramadan wasn't happy for everyone in Palestine. I want to tell you just a short story about one family I met. They were grieving, this family of 8 children and mother and father. The oldest son had been killed a week before. It would be like, how do you celebrate the Christmas season when you've lost a child? Very difficult. Several of our group heard about this family, and we went to visit them in the afternoon. The mother told this story, and we had people who were bilingual, Arabic and English, so this is how I heard about it. The boy was 13, Mahmoud. He caught birds. He would sell them at the market. He did this to assist his mother, who was basically raising the family. The father had been severely injured physically and mentally by the violence there. Mahmoud would sell the birds, make money, so he could help pay for his school supplies, books, and his clothes to take some of the pressure off his mother. He and a friend were searching for birds, trying to capture them, and evidently they got a little too close to the border with Israel. And they were pursued by soldiers. One got away, Mahmoud's friend, but Mahmoud did not. Now this is what it was told to us. This 13-year-old boy was shot 17 times. He evidently was stomped on by the soldiers. Now his mother is telling us this, and of course she is weeping. She shows us his coat. She had been called to the morgue. Of course, you get a phone call that says, "Please come to the morgue," or, "I'm a police officer. We have some news for you." She goes crazy. Now, this is several days later that she's telling this to us, and soon it's time to break the fast. So our team goes out and buys some food, but of course, the family expects us to stay, and they're going to throw a feast. So with our food and their food, it's a bounty. They say, "Please stay with us tonight." And we say, "Sure." So we drink tea. We watch the news. My friend Laura, who's a 21-year-old American Jew, she knows some Arabic, so she helps translate the conversation she's having with the mother. We sleep over. The next morning, the mother says to Laura and me, "Thank you. We feel, with you being here, some happiness in our life. It is like Mahmoud is still here with us. Thank you." What did we do? What did I do? I was there. I tried to listen as best I could through translation. It meant something to many Palestinians of all walks of life that I, an American professor, would come leave my family, would come all that distance to be with them. It is very humbling, friends. I don't know what your, there was a joke made about your liberal orientation. I don't say this with disrespect, but it is a difficult situation to be in, to be in a Palestinian family's living room with the television on and to see President Bush come on and make a statement about peace in the Middle East. And the Palestinians kind of look at you. And then they say, but you don't agree with your president, right? Why go to Palestine? To get a little taste. I worked in the olive harvest. I stayed with families in Gaza whose homes were threatened with demolition. I went back my last 2 weeks of my time to spend some days with a friend, Murad, whose family we had assisted with their olives. We went to their village, of course. The red carpet is brought out for me. But I have to leave the village to go to Ramallah to catch a taxi to Tel Aviv because four St. Louis friends of mine are coming to do the work that I've been doing. And so since I'd been there, I was going to escort them into the world that is Palestine. So on our way out of the village in a taxi, we hit what's called a flying checkpoint, where some jeeps are just parked across the road, and you have to stop, get out of your car, show your ID. Now, I made the big mistake of having a pamphlet from UNICEF on my possession. UNICEF is a UN agency. And it was a documentary booklet about munitions Israel has used against children, teenagers. Now, the soldier goes through my backpack, finds this, and starts shouting. And I think he's saying, terrorist, pointing to me. Gets on the phone, calls his superior. Murad, my friend, he's about 26, he's a welder by profession. He says, you do not know who I am, we just met. We just met in the cab. Murad, why, what do you mean? Just do what I say. Okay, he's Palestinian, he's been through this. Jeeps arrive, Murad, I, Ahmed, the cab driver, we're handcuffed, we're blindfolded, we're put into the back of a Jeep, we're taken, I'm not sure where. I found out later it's a Jewish settlement in the West Bank where the soldiers have their barracks. And we're brought into this room and it's a den. Not D-E-N, D-I-N. The noise, the doors, the bluster. I'm blindfolded. I don't know what's happening. And I'm with two Palestinians. And some of the soldiers, who are, of course, the age of my students. I tried to stay calm, thinking, I wouldn't be intimidated by any of my students. Why should I be intimidated by these 21-year-olds? Well, they've got rifles. That's one thing. One of them threw an empty Coke can at my head. They said snide things to me, but I'm being very polite. Because if I say something wrong, well, maybe they'll take it out on me. But maybe, in all likelihood, knowing what I know about the situation, they're going to take it out on Murad and Ahmed. If they're still with me. And at one point, because we're blindfolded, I hear Murad whisper to me, it's going to be okay. We'll get out of this. Now, he really shouldn't be whispering to me because we supposedly don't know each other. Hour after hour after hour after hour. Finally, we get transferred to another settlement where I am to meet with a Israeli security officer who had been called from Tel Aviv to come over to visit with me. I felt special. It's 1 or 2 in the morning now. He says, it was the first friendly voice I'd heard in many hours. Tell us what you're doing here. I had my little ruse, because I know as soon as I tell them what I'm doing there, they'll send me home. I get into these, okay, I'm an academic, discussions with the Shin Bet officer about the recent Jewish history, what happened in Europe, how one has to take a stand. He's very polite with me, but he says, who are you and what are you doing here? This went on cat and mouse for an hour. They had all my notebooks. If they read them, they would have seen I was with the International Solidarity Movement. Ultimately, they let us go. They drive us back to the cab, and because they thought we were terrorists, they looked in the cab for any kind of explosive, and I don't know, made $2,000-$3,000 worth of damage to this new taxi. We go back to Ramallah to Murad's family's house. 30 of them are waiting for us. We called. When I didn't pick my friends up at the Tel Aviv airport, they called our friends back in Louisville and St. Louis, a telephone tree. Do you all have something like that here? Like in case of a wedding or funeral or something? Well, we had planned this, if something happened to any of us, to call this person who would set the telephone tree in motion. And in this case, since that afternoon, people in the United States had been calling the American embassy and consulate saying, where's our friend? Where's our teacher? And he's traveling with two Palestinians. So the Israelis knew who I was because they'd been getting all these calls. So it's kind of a comedy of errors, I guess. Anyway, the family is overjoyed that we're there. And one woman, maybe 30, looks at me with a little smile. So, this is good for you. A little taste of what we face every day. It's good learning for you. I've offered you some reasons why I and others have gone to Palestine. When you leave your comfort zone, you can learn a lot. When you interfere with injustice, you can meet some amazing people. John mentioned about my wife. I know what it's like to be comforted by friends. And when you've had affliction, after some time and you get better, and you see somebody that's afflicted, you want to be there for them. Zaina planted a seed in me. I got to know some wonderful Palestinian people and get a small taste, which I haven't forgotten. But how do we return to the USA? Well, after an experience like that, some of us are fortunate to be in front of people like you, to share a little bit about that experience. Some of us, like our friends at the Center for Theology, we sell Palestinian olive oil to benefit children in the refugee camps. Some of us go to Peoria and protest at the Caterpillar headquarters because Caterpillar makes those bulldozers Israel uses to take down Palestinian homes, and not just the homes of terrorists. Some of us write letters to the editor, write op-eds, articles, and books. One of my students is an actor. She wrote a play about her experience last summer and put it on the other night at St. Louis University. And some people afflict the comfortable simply by using the word Palestine. In conclusion, I just want to mention that I often think of the French writer Albert Camus. In 1948, Camus met with a group of Christians. They were having a spirited discussion about all that had just happened in Europe, the war which ended 3 years before. Camus was honest. He was an agnostic, not a person of faith. He was a little troubled, though, that the Catholic Pope did not raise his voice in support of the Jewish people who were being exterminated. And some of the Christians who were discussing with Camus said, well, he did speak. And Camus said, well, okay. But it was in the language, if any of you come from a Catholic background, you'll understand this, it was in the language of the encyclicals, by which Camus meant dry, dense, lacking passion. Camus then shared with these Christians a simple challenge, which I'd like to offer to you. What the world expects of Christians is that Christians should speak out loud and clear, and that they should voice their condemnation in such a way that never a doubt, never the slightest doubt, could arise in the heart of the simplest man or woman. That Christians should get away from abstraction and confront the blood-stained face history has taken on today. The grouping we need is a grouping of women and men resolved to speak out clearly and to pay up personally. Thank you for your kind attention.